The Creative Trust is a podcast about the creative process. Amanda Henderson founded Gloss Creative in 2001 and has been making fabulous happen ever since. Gloss Creative and its alumni have mastered the art of creative renewal. Listen as Amanda sits down to explore some of the world's best creative minds. These are their insights, and this is their legacy. Welcome to the Creative Trust.
I'm sitting here with two design besties, I'm going to call them. For a while, I've been wondering what would happen if I put these two together. I've worked with them both. They are both incredible female founders who started their businesses not yesterday. They've created two incredibly groundbreaking design businesses, and they've made such a valuable contribution to the Australian design world. I met Claire Cousins from Claire Cousin Architects in 2004 while she was working at Woods Marsh with Roger and Randall, and we were both a part of a project team for Moët & Chandon where we created a marquee in the birdcage, still referred to in our studio today as the Digital Rose Marquee. So that was where we met. Welcome, Claire. And the wonderful Grazia Matera from Grazia & Co. And I remember walking down the aisles of many design fairs and happily chatting to this very chatty, gorgeous person who had this beautiful bar design, and we were very excited about it. And then in 2016, Grazia released the Featherstone range, and I was able to put six of those beautiful scape chairs into a marquee as well. And we've all been chatting happily ever since. In 2014, these two got together and created and brought to market the Ivy Coffee Table. And since then, they have rolled with this beautiful design in all manner of material iterations. So this led me to wondering, what kind of relationship do you have to collaborate and create together? What's the chemistry that connects creators? Are they friends as well? Well, turns out they are. Welcome to Claire and Grazia. Thanks for coming today.
No, they're not
going to
be here.
Yeah, so good. I can't wait to get all of this information out from you two. So we're going to start with your younger years. So what I'm interested in is how you both got creative.
My uncle, Rick Eckersley, my mum's brother, so he, with another uncle, a number of landscape businesses. So I was reflecting on spending long childhood school holidays in the potting shed of the wholesale nursery, which was in Glen Iris, where they used to grow a lot of the kind of plant stock, or out at Canterbury when they had one of the nurseries there. So I think that, being around, Rick always said, oh, you got it from me. Like he always used to say.
Taking full credit.
Yeah, because I've come from my mum, and our mum was a nurse, my dad's a doctor. And other little things, I suppose, too, of just reflecting on making things from, you know, I was never allowed a Barbie doll. They would never buy me a Barbie. I think it was a kind of.
It was an era.
So I got the Cindy dolls. You know, they were the kind of maybe cheaper, maybe slightly more body normal. And I still found a few years ago when we were moving house a box of these because, again, they probably weren't buying me any of the clothes and the accessories that I wanted, but I would cut up Dad's socks and make little belts and these brown kind of strapless dresses with belts. And so it was kind of, as an architect, people go, were you into Lego? And I was like, well, no, not really, you know, but it was kind of just making things from what was available. And that was a kind of an interest for me. What about you, Grants?
I don't know where it started. I do remember having to work in my mum's hair salon, and back then people would get a perm. Lots of people don't even know what a perm is now.
But no, I do, don't worry.
They were these coloured rods, perm rods, and I remember thinking the colours were fabulous and they were all different sizes, and I remember always wanting to arrange them. And I remember doing the window, styling the window with the new conditioners and the new hairsprays.
How old are you when you're doing this?
It was after school. I'd walk to my mum's salon and on Saturdays I'd work there on Saturdays. And
a teenager.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I think I got the
early visual merchandising.
Yeah. Totally. Which is actually what I wanted to do to start with. But anyway, that's probably my earliest memory of being doing something. Oh, these colours are good, and, you know, styling the window in the hair salon with product.
So was your education helpful?
No.
No.
I went to an all-girls Catholic school. Nothing wrong with an all-girls Catholic school. I just don't think it was focused on the arts as such, you know. And it was a different time, I think, the 80s or the 70s actually, 70s, 80s. I don't think so. I think my later education at RMIT certainly, obviously that's the area that I went into. I wanted to do visual merchandising but didn't get in.
So, seriously?
Yeah, I got into interior decoration and design and then I transferred into the design part. But I remember thinking, oh, that's the course I really wanted to do. But in hindsight, I ended up being where I should have been, really.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that. How did you decide to do that course? There must have been something there that you went, okay, this is for me.
Unlike Claire, who did maths and sciences through her education, I wasn't great at school and I just knew that the creative side was more where I enjoyed than, you know, look at what architects do now and I know that it's something I probably wouldn't have the capacity to have done. And I loved furniture. I remember going to Italy and we had cousins of ours that had this great 70s furniture and I remember thinking, what is this? You know, it was kind of space age back then. So I remember there was things like that that influenced me. So I remember when I did get into interior design, I remember all those classics coming. At the time I didn't know what they were, but they might have been, you know, little Andrea Ponti and, you know, they had that look, you know, the terrazzo floors and, you know, things like that were definitely the back of my mind as a child. And then getting into RMIT, I think that influenced me a little bit.
So did you go to Italy a lot when you were a kid or?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, we actually went, Claire and I went last year actually to the island where my family's from, which is Salina in Sicily. We had a great time. But yeah, I did as a child. I lived there with my grandparents, you know, for 6 months of the year and then we'd come back and or we'd do a month trip and come back. And
we didn't speak English. You started prep here and she didn't speak English.
I didn't speak really broken English, yeah.
I'm sure you're bilingual.
I am bilingual.
Yeah, there you
occasionally
go.
I don't say things in the right context in English and I remind Claire that English is my second language.
Did you also go to Milan together?
Not recently, no.
Yeah, that was our first.
That was our firming our friendship.
I love it.
Took us into the sisterhood category of friendship, I think, that trip.
Because I remember Claire was finding all these great hotels that we couldn't afford and we're like, okay, we'll just sleep together.
First we met in Amsterdam, so we did this trip to Amsterdam. Yeah. But we wanted to, and of course everyone back then, this is 18 years ago, and we, of course, had the wallpaper guide because you just did what wallpaper told you, would tell you the good places to go. So we found this really cool hotel, but it was so expensive. But we thought, what if we just share the room in and share the bed? That was fine. I think they didn't give us a twin, and we're like, whatever.
Whatever.
Anyway, then we moved on to Milan.
We've all
and
done that.
I think we left the booking really late, and so there was nothing left in Milan in our price point. So we were probably in the equivalent of Frankston. We were somewhere, but we still had a fantastic time. But I still remember the morning we woke up in this hotel, random kind of commercial hotel, and we opened the curtains and looked down to this enormous car park, but there was this enormous flea market and we thought we'd hit the jackpot. And we thought, we're probably in Frankston, but look at this flea market. And we bought all these great trinkets and because Gratz and I used to love doing the Campbell market every weekend and until our partners told us to stop acquiring more random chairs and ceramics.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So your collectors, clearly.
Yeah.
No, we're more controlled now.
Much more controlled, yeah.
You're more curated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Claire, tell us about how you progressed from school to university. Like Grant said, you know, you were into maths. Tell us about how you went from school into this architecture. What was that moment?
Yeah, I think I went to a co-ed school that I actually did a lot of drama and so that was, I suppose, my more, you do the compulsory art, but then when it got into your electives in the last few years, the school really pushed me. I think they were really pushing girls into STEM. If you were good at maths, capable at maths and science, you should do that. So I did that and I kind of enjoyed it, but I did have a kind of creative outlet with drama and whatnot. Musicals. But I had no idea. I just thought, oh, I'm going to be an engineer. Like I was just, I kind of liked doing things that girls didn't often do. Like I liked kind of going against the grain. But then at the very last minute I saw at the top of the list was A for architecture. And I thought, oh, maybe that's sort of interesting. And I think my dad was very encouraging when I suggested it. It was a total guess, but I thought, oh, at least it's a bit of engineering and a bit of maybe creativity. applied for Melbourne because when I kind of walked around, I was actually doing open days yesterday for my, I've got a year 12 at the moment. And I said to her, don't judge it by the campus, because the year I went around, I went to Melbourne and thought, look, the campus is beautiful. RMIT was in the back blocks because they were building the new architecture school. It was just terrible. So I didn't want to go to RMIT. Didn't get into Melbourne, didn't get into RMIT, got into Deakin. And then RMIT was only taking 40 students at the time. And then I still, there's a guy, Daniel Falkenberg, who was going on kibbutz to Israel, and he deferred. And I've said to him, thanks to your Jewish heritage, I get to go to architecture school at RMIT because it popped me in as a second round offer. So
amazing.
And went to RMIT, which was great for me because it was, RMIT was at such an interesting phase. There was heaps of kind of people, academics from London, from the AA. Sand Helsel had just taken up the head of the department. So this kind of powerful American trained female architect. It was a really exciting time, and it was super conceptual, which was weird for me because I was very pragmatic, logical, you know, methodical, and RMIT completely threw me in the deep end to think completely outside of the square, which was, I think, what I needed, that real shake up.
I love that. And you're describing also something I love, which is people who are logical and can do maths and love all that STEM stuff, but also who are creative as well. I think that part of creativity makes me so happy. You know, often creatives are painted in one light, you know, that's the only thing you can do. And I love the concept of creative people as business people and commerciality as well. So I'm pretty excited to hear
all
of that.
There's so much sort of space, you know, a spatial, the maths and science is hugely helpful. I think there's a lot of intuition that I draw on for design, but I think there's also a huge amount of rationale, you know, logic, methodically working through things. And I think that in particularly in architecture, having those two, I think, really work together. And a lot of architects, we would argue, the amount of time we use creativity is actually a very small. You're constantly drawing upon finding good design solutions, but when you're really in that full creative mode is probably 5-10% of our time, sadly.
I know. It's the best bit too.
I know,
it's so fun, isn't it? So after you left school, Graz, and you went to university, what happened then? Did you love it?
I loved it. I did love it. My first job was in furniture, actually. And then while I was still studying, I was working in a retail furniture store. And then there was a job going with Gordon Mather Industries, who at the time had and still does have the license for the Featherstone collection. So I applied for that job and was there for 10 years. So that kind of embedded me into furniture, really, Australian-made furniture too and designed. So that was a great learning time. Gordon was great.
What sort of things did he teach you?
Simple things like, you know, which timbers have better grain for staining and which ones are considered a soft timber, like things that came into furniture construction, of which you touch on at university or in interior design, but you don't really delve into it too much, you know. What species are Australian? Which ones are plantation? You know, like those things actually matter now, especially because, you know, we don't specify teak because it's usually a rainforest timber. So things like that I think really are valuable, you know, to know today. I think the process of the way Featherstone pieces were made and how ahead of the time they were, and, you know, back then Mary Featherstone was still involved with Gordon at the time. And it was just a privilege to work with people like Gordon and Mary. And again, it was a trade business, so you deal with a lot of the architects and designers, some of which I still work with today, our luckily cousins, and Woodmarsh, which was our original connection, really, wasn't it?
How did you start Graz Hearing Co?
I think after being in another business where we imported, where you actually, even though it was kind of lucrative because labour overseas was cheaper, so product was cheaper and, you know, we'd bring in pieces and the margin was good. I think what I was more horrified about is, one, the working standards and also the amount of packaging that was with imported goods, and that made me kind of look back at where I'd come from with Gordon, where there was no packaging and there was no wastage and we were doing it all here. And at the time a lot of people had moved to products that were made abroad rather than, and, you know, slowly all the trades here were going, and I just thought it was a good opportunity to try and bring it back a little bit. And it was hard. You know, we don't have updated machinery here. There's a lot of the trades have retired, the people that we used to use with Gordon. So it was a bit of a challenge, but I felt like we can produce Olympians, Australian Olympians. We can produce, you know, we should be able to have another Patricia Koala in this country too, you know, that we can make things here. I think there is a lot of talent in this country.
Absolutely.
You know? So it was about harnessing that and, you know, having our own collection, and then the collaboration part with all the with the other architects was where it kind of led us, really, and it's been great. Now we've got Featherston and Meadmore, so they're like big.
They're icons.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably been our biggest step moving into that collection. But yeah.
So what led you, Claire, to the establishment of your studio?
I worked all through my undergrad in various practices. Although, you know, I worked for a furniture company, I worked for a builder for a few years. But that's the thing I always say, if I ever cross paths with kind of architecture students, you have to work while you're a student, because when you're a graduate, you're expected to kind of know more than what just they teach you at uni. So I kind of had a few kind of, you know, as a student only, but runs on the board when I graduated. I worked for a couple of three different architects, and the last being Woodmarsh, which is where Gratz and I met, and Roger and Randall are dear friends to this day. We actually celebrated 20 years this year for our practice.
Amazing.
So I started that when I was 29.
So just going back to Woodmarsh, obviously they're an icon studio in Australia. What was it that you took away from that experience with the both of them?
Had a party.
That's true. That's how Gratz and I formed our friendship, because Gratz and Gordon, you know, Gordon Mather would supply Woodmarsh, and Gratz was often kind of regularly in the office bringing in waterfalls of fabric and different things. Oh, I think it's so interesting. I think there's so many things that actually would, A, they're a partnership, and I'm not in a partnership. So I think hats off to people who do partnerships, because there's pros and cons, you know, which is great. I think they also approach architecture quite differently to me, but it was such an enormous steep learning curve. Like the breadth of projects that they do, they've always approached, I think, architecture in a very kind of sculptural manner. Interestingly, because I had a real passion for interior spaces and the macro, the sort of small, you know, we often design buildings probably from the inside out, which sounds a bit strange, but it's more about rather than what it looks like from the outside. And I think I always find it very interesting watching how some architects really kind of design how it's going to sit in the landscape as this object, and then almost kind of go in and sort of sort it out. So,
I mean, maybe that inside look relates to how people are going to use the space.
Yeah.
You know, and feel in it.
Mm.
Maybe that's a pretty good way to start, the end user.
That's right. There's no right or wrong. It's just, so it's interesting. I think just being given a lot of rope, principally on houses, and then jumping in on other projects and all of these kind of creative pursuits, there's so much to be learned from observing, listening, sitting next to someone. How do they talk to a client? How do you talk to a builder? How do you use your diplomacy to kind of sort through problems? There's always fires and problems and, you know, things to solve. And there's a lot to be said about, I always remember kind of Roger would, you know, just have this immense kind of calmness that he would, you know, and often you'd feel like he was, the way he could still stay across all of the details and the information on a project, but actually not be that across it from a day to day, but that you can. And I always, you know, I was out the back doing the drawings, and I thought, oh, one day, can't wait till I just sit in meetings all day. Because they were always in meetings, and I was regularly in meetings, but, you know, obviously only a short. And now I say to my team, one day I'm going to sit out the back. I'm in meetings all day, you know, because it looks so easy sitting in the meetings the whole time.
Yeah.
But you're actually like paddling like a duck underwater often, you know, or just, I feel like you're kind of not performing, but you're giving so much of yourself often when you, because you're trying to solve things. It's very interesting. Anyway, it's just funny how sometimes as a junior architect and you look at the boss and you think that they're having a lovely old time. Actually, they're working really hard.
I used to think my boss at sports school was just sitting in his office drawing. And of course he was, because he was thinking up the next thing. I'm like, yeah, same thing. Imagine just sitting there and drawing all day. And it's like, well, that's kind of what I do now, you know, apart from in meetings.
Yeah, that's right.
So why did you establish your studio?
I'm a little bit bossy and a little bit of a control freak, and I just knew I had to do it for myself. And Gratz is nodding here in the background. So I know I just had this kind of real yearning to do it. And I did start, some people start with the big, like a commission, which gives them a kind of a kick to do it. I had been doing quite a lot of, I certainly wasn't actively looking to do private work on the side, because I, you know, but you know, you do get the odd family friend that said, oh, can you draw me a kitchen? You know, so you do sort of little bits and bobs on weekends for friends. But I just took the leap of faith, and it probably took a year till I got an actual proper renovation project. I was just doing lots of bathrooms, kitchens, curtains, like whatever, you know, like just all these lots of little bits and, you know, pieces, you know, pretty unglamorous. But actually I'm a big believer in learning by doing, that you kind of, when you do that many, you get really familiar with all the reps and the tiles and the suppliers, and kind of brings me joy. I really like making things for people, and when you see what was there before and how it functions afterwards, it was still quite fun to do those small projects. But yeah, just started small and then grew from there.
Wow. And as you said, 20 years of growth. Where are you now with the business after 20 years? Where are you in your head?
I think we had a bit of a pivot in maybe after the 10-year mark. I kind of realised that we were very reactionary, or people would offer us a job, we'd say yes, we'd do it, and then we'd head down and then the next one. And at 10 years I kind of felt it was important to be more, and those jobs were great, there was no problem with that, but it was a kind of a good opportunity to sit back and think, what projects do we really want to do? And we were doing lots of houses. We love doing single res housing, and I think it will always be our kind of first love. But it kind of also aligned with maybe starting working on Nightingale project and also national president role. And it kind of made me lift my head. I was always head down, bum up, just delivery, 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 next project. But when you're in those slightly different roles where you're thinking about advocacy, challenges in society, it made us sort of think more about, so we started, I suppose, being maybe more open to multi-res social housing projects, because I was kind of publicly talking about them on behalf of the Institute of Architects. And I think also you get to a point where you're ready to start taking on new challenges. You know, you don't want to sort of plateau. I love a kind of steep trajectory in learning. So it's really nice. I think a lot of our work in the last kind of 7 years, we've been doing a lot more of that. And it's a way, I'm a big believer that good design is for everybody. It's not just for the few that can afford to commission an architect to do a house. And it's really interesting when you're flexing a muscle on really lean, really utilitarian, but how do you inject delight and into materiality and the kind of spatial quality, and how these essentially mass kind of housing projects for who you don't know who the end client is, how can you bring some of the qualities that we deliver in our single res into those projects? Well, you develop a real muscle in that, and then with the single res, and they really kind of ironically kind of can feed each other. And it's a really, it's nice to also have a difference, because house projects are very emotional, they're intimate, and I really enjoy that part of them, but that can be exhausting doing that all the time, you know, every single project. And then there's something nice about doing some of the, you know, the bigger projects, which are a bit, you know, less emotional, and they're kind of faster and bigger, and it's more focusing on the bigger ideas. You don't get so hung up on exactly where does that light fitting go. It's not that critical. It's more important, like, how does the facade work? How does the ground plane work? How does it work for the broader community, those kind of things. So that's been good.
When you think about success and what it means to you, when you think about, you know, the things that you've created, whether it was Nightingale, how do you view success? What do you think successful is for you?
I really think success is the fact that I managed to find a career that I'm able to do things that I, you know, love. I say, because I've got kids kind of starting to think about what they might do at uni, I keep saying to them, you just have to work. We spend so many hours at work. You have to think about what makes you tick, what's going to get you up in the morning when you really can't be bothered. So I do feel, as creatives, like, we're very lucky to have something that I constantly feel fulfilled. You know, yes, I have bad days. Yes, you have hard decisions and those things, but it is really such a delight. And also that we can also feel with our practice too that we're doing some social good too. It's not just making pretty things or beautiful things. There's actually, how can we try and have a small impact on improving housing for people that we'll never meet?
I think it's such a great thing that you've chosen something that you also have the skill for. I see a lot on social media about whether you should pick a career that you love, and a lot of people say, no, don't pick a career that you love. Pick a career that you have the ability in. That way you can make a living. And it's a really interesting thing, but isn't it great if you've got both?
Mm.
That's the golden ticket, isn't it? And Graz, how long has your business been going?
10 years this year.
Congratulations. Thank you. That's incredible.
Yeah.
How have you gone in that time? Like, you know, obviously you started out.
Yep.
And when I look at, you know, when I visit the showroom where you are now, you've got so many collaborations and incredible things. How's that whole progression been for you?
I think the progression with the collaborations, well, originally Claire's was the first one, which was a bit by accident really. You designed a coffee table and asked if we could make it. We worked out how to make it and we loved it, and then we worked out how to have it interchangeable with different tops and be able to export it, which we do. And
was it something that you were placing into a home?
No, I just designed something I couldn't find that I wanted for myself, because there were no round tables really, and I wanted something big, sort of 1200, and I kind of am often drawn to simple volumetric, you know. I just loved the kind of chunky legs. I think the first design was glass, so that you saw the kind of leg through the glass, but then we thought we could also do it in stone and different colours and things. And so anyway, and the funny thing was Gratz kept saying, it needs a name. And I'm like, I haven't thought of a name yet. And I'm like, I don't know. And then it had three legs. She goes, well, I'm calling it Ivy, which is one of my daughter's names, because it's got three letters and three names. And I'm like, oh, okay.
So no particular reason. So
she just said, it's called Ivy. I'm like, okay, no problem. Anyway, so it's been great. And I think that's the great thing with these is there was a need, you know, I had a need for it. We put it in a lot of projects. But then Gratz, as well as being highly creative and clever, but brings that manufacturing lens, and it's super simple, but often the simple things, you know, that need, you know, more attention. And then she'll often say, oh, I've thought about a new colour combo, and like, looks great, you know. Yeah. So it's always evolving, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
So you're still selling that table 10 years later.
Yep. And that's the thing.
And did you say export?
We export it. Yeah, we have a lovely agent in the US.
Fantastic. Who,
they choose what they like from the ranges, but he definitely purchases the Ivy.
I do think the Ivy coffee table, when that first came out, was sort of, you know, a signal, I guess, to everyone that, you know, the squareness of what a lot of furniture that had been, it was the beginning of the round. And I know I've heard you say, you know, you love a square with a circle in the centre of it. That's one of your sort of things. And I was like, remembering at the time, this is different. This is not your standard coffee table. And just this attractive, you know, this roundness and these curves and these, you know, chunky cylinder, as you said, it was really different 10 years ago. I mean, there's many different kind of iterations of round things now. But I think at the time it really was a great signal to everyone that things were changing.
Well, I think it's withstood the test of time. It was like, you know, it's mechanically fixed, so it's easy to, like I said, it's interchangeable and done different sizes. It's good. But that's brought in a lot of other collaborations with other designers that we work with. So that's been great, because what that does is really highlight, you know, again, Australian design. Today's designers that are designing for, they might be architects, they might be interior designers, and bringing their visions into the furniture range. And then at the same time, we've got, you know, the legendary pieces of Featherstone and Meadmore. So together, I think it's a lovely offering, you know, that you've got well celebrated designers all.
And I've seen, you know, as well as collaborations, you know, every, I don't know, 18 months or 2 years, you add something new in to your ranges. Is there, within your team, what's the process for bringing new things on? Do you just talk about it all day?
No, we definitely talk about other things, painful clients. No. We talk not every day, no, but we do. You see gaps in the market, and I think that's, as I've gotten older, we out-design. We don't sit at a desk and say, I'm going to design a chair today. It normally comes from a design brief for a project where you think, oh, yeah, there really isn't anything like that on the market. Let's, you know, and we make a lot of things that we don't have in the range because they might not have been a viable thing to make ongoingly, or they might have been very specifically bespoke for that project. So you just make them for that project. So these days, while we do include pieces that we design in-house that we feel like fulfill the range, or there's a gap in the collection that we need, it's almost a little bit different now. From a business sense, I think about what can our tooling and what can our machinery make you know, what radius can I get on that bender, or, you know, will it bend tube instead of rod? So those things actually start, that's how you think as you
invasive
get older.
Thoughts you act on.
Well, you do, because you think that's how I have to make something with this radius, or I can't get that, I can do this, you know. So you think differently. I think when you first start out, you think, oh, you can design
anything.
You can do anything, you know, and it just doesn't work like that from a business sense, because, well, first of all, you have to make it at a price that you can then sell it at, and that's a big thing in today's market as well.
And every interior designer out there would like to thank you for the first ever dining chair and high good-looking bar stool ever made in Australia.
Yes, that's right.
Because that was a drought for a very long time. Every time our clients would say, we need bar stools, we'd go, no, because yeah. They were the ugliest thing on the earth.
Well, that
and
was...
you've really, that dining chair market and, you know, having a higher version of that has been such a godsend, in my opinion.
Well, thanks, Amanda. It's been a godsend to us too.
But you really captured that need. Like you're saying, in the market, yeah. There was this, apart from the beautiful scape dining chair.
Yes.
Apart from that, there was nothing. You know, there was Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a lot else.
Oh, well, that's good. Good to hear.
Yeah. And I love, once again, you've, you know, bought that out in different iterations, as you said, of fabric.
Yeah.
Of, you know, you're very good with your colour palette. It's like you also go shopping for fashion as well. You've always got the,
yeah,
you know,
we try.
What's next. The way you render your colour palettes, I feel, is always very elevated and sophisticated. It's definitely the Italian version of the trend.
Yeah. It's interesting, you come out with something and you think, oh, God, this is going to be a winner. And there's crickets, there's nothing. And then there'll be something you think, oh, we'll just try it, and then it goes off. So you actually don't know until you get it onto the market what's going to be accepted or specified. You really don't. You know, Claire's a sounding board. Sometimes it'll be absolutely not.
Yeah, or that's one of my sayings.
And I'm like, okay. Or she'll go, that's great. You know, so it's nice to get, you know, friends and our in-house team, everyone's got an opinion, which I love, because, you know, you get the truth of what you're
paid for.
That's right. So,
but Graz kind of touches on, it's a side issue, but there's something really nice when you, I mean, Graz's husband, Steve, is very much part of a business partner and part of the company as well. But from a creative side, it's actually been so good. And that's what really brought us together so closely when we started our businesses 20 years ago was, as sole directors, which you were back then, you actually kind of do need a pseudo director or sound. It's really nice to have that sounding board. And Graz kind of knows the architecture industry well as an outsider, you know, because she's kind of working with so many of those people all the time.
Yeah.
But it's, anyway, it is interesting. And often I'll call Graz and she'll be like, are you talking about? No, that's a terrible idea, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, and you know, and you've got other friends, I've got other architects, but leading your own practice, whether, you know, and to have your kind of female friends even more than good friends, to have that kind of support, I think is fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's nice that you've got someone who can be honest in all areas, you know. I think that's what we both, whether we want to hear it or not at times, yeah. But
That's the crux of it, isn't it, the honesty? Because we fashion shop together, but we're quite different in height, and Graz will put me in things that I would never, you know, vice versa, and she'll go, that looks horrendous on you, know, like, but we can actually, you can, to have that kind of, I have been known to buy her a present and she goes, sorry, I don't like it. And so I'm like, always been scarred by it. But, you know, but you actually do want, you don't just want people saying yes. Fundamentally, you know, because you know that they've got your best interest at heart. So there's that loyalty, but they're also telling you sometimes what you don't want to hear. And I think, anyway,
Just
made me think of it when you said that before, that was all.
One of the questions that I had, is this a work thing or do you socialise? And it is, your friends.
Friends first.
Friends first.
Yeah, definitely.
But we met through work, I suppose.
But you met through work.
Yeah.
I love that.
Not that it's a competition, as Roger Wood would say, but I met them first.
I love that.
But, it's true. Yeah, we're definitely more friends now.
But I had
dinner
with him last night. I'm just joking. Cut that, Amanda.
Cut that bit out. I was invited. I just didn't go.
That's true. Sorry, we're getting a bit loose now. Concentrate.
So what is it that makes you click? Do you think is what you were describing before, you have that respect for each other? Or what is it that you admire about each other?
I think because Claire's such a goody-goody that I love to push the bound. I try and make her naughty at times, and I think I'm the only one that's been able to push it to the point where it gets messy, but I'm kind of proud of that achievement. But no, I think we're very different. We're very, very different, which
I was just actually going to say we're super different, but we actually often could finish each other's sentences, or even with the design thing.
Yeah, we'll pick the same thing.
We are very aligned. But then occasionally she'll go, oh, that's a terrible, you know. So, but I reckon 90% of the things we're on the same. And not that that's essential for a friendship, but I think when you've got so many things in common, you know, we travel together, or we, you know, we'll go to look at art, or, you know, or enjoy food and restaurants. Our families get along. We've got kids a similar age. And I think that's what's nice is we've got, there's just different, and values, you know, you've got to kind of tick all those boxes in different kind of, like, why do you pick up the phone and talk on a daily basis? It's because you've got someone that you want to chew the fat with or have a whinge about, or, you know, those kind of things. So
do you talk to each other all the time?
Yeah.
Amazing. I love that.
Probably 3 times a day.
Oh, that
more
is
more than my husband, actually.
Yeah, it is. It is a strange.
And sometimes it's work. Sometimes I have to go, I'm ringing about work, because then she knows.
Okay. Oh, then I won't. I'll get a text saying it's a work call, and then I'll take it because I think it's another or vice versa. Because then we'll take the call.
Or she'll call me and she goes, oh, I can tell you're in work mode because my answers are really short and we can't have a kind of a chow down, but. No,
she has an office voice.
Yeah.
And a working from
home.
What's
the office voice like?
It's very stiff. It's like, oh,
you can't. It's just when she calls in, I'm in an open plan office and she wants to kind of talk about stuff. And I'm like, mm-hmm.
The short answer. Yeah. Can I help you?
Yeah.
I love it. Talk to me about your thoughts of the current Australian design landscape. I'd love to know also, what about where you feel you contribute to it? Where do you sit within it?
I mean, I could speak on behalf of, like, with architects. I think there's a fantastic collegiate community of architects. Are you kind of talking about, like, what design does in Australia, or when
just
you say
when the first thing that comes into your mind?
Mm.
You know, because people say design world, it's so vast.
Yeah.
And often I find those questions around, you know, what does design mean? What does this mean? Are just crazy wide.
Yeah.
Any part of it that you find interesting?
I think the thing, when I'm reflecting on the kind of work that is produced in Australia, you know, architectural or design, we punch really well above our weight per capita. When you look, you know, if you look at international awards or, you know, magazines or publications, it's kind of astounding. And often I think people put that down to that we're quite unhindered as a younger nation. Obviously, we've got First Nations, you know, very long history, but post-colonisation compared to Europe, where often architects can often be limited to interior architecture, or buildings must have a pitched roof, and because of the kind of heritage control. The backside, or the bad side to that, the downside to that, is that we also end up with, because we're essentially kind of less regulated from an aesthetic perspective, which we wonder why we love European cities, because they look so beautiful and they've been kept intact.
But they're very samey.
A good way. And then we get the freedom here, but then you see the monstrosities in the suburbs. There's a lot of poorly built, poorly conceived. And so I think while we do have that freedom as architects, which is great, but architecture is the tiniest proportion of what is built. I do think we've got a long way to kind of for people to understand or normalize design in everything. You look at the kind of Japanese or the Danes. Design is kind of, it's like a language that's educated from birth, you know, that
it's infused.
It's infused, you know, it's in the objects they use, it's in all the schools, you know, it's in the architecture. And here in Australia, I think to the general public, design is seen as a luxury, you know, that it's a nice to have optional extra. And I do think the more we can, whether it be industrial design or furniture or architecture, the more that we can kind of educate people that design shouldn't cost more and it should be considered across everything. That's a kind of a big change that I think would be great for Australia to kind of develop in the next 50 or 100 years. And, you know, how do we kind of embed that knowledge and innovation?
I find a lot of creative process, you know, when you think of houses, I think people confuse luxury with the luxury of thoughtfulness. Like, to be thoughtful doesn't cost money. To think of something, a way something might be, you know, if you think of a house, the way a view, a sense of place within a house, that doesn't necessarily cost money. It sometimes just takes the thought.
Mm.
And I feel like across all creative industries, we find this as well, you know, when you're describing, you know, designing stuff to, everyone designs to a budget, you know, you're thinking, oh, how can we get the walls up? How can we do this and that? But really it's about the thought. And I feel like your intentions, your skills and all of that, it's really the thought that counts with all of this stuff. And if you very much ground yourself in that thought and that giving over, it shouldn't cost more money in a way.
No, that's right.
I don't know. I think it's something that this thought, taking time for people to think and think of amazing things to with their work and to find the best way and have the vision is something that, as you said, once you get out of these perceived luxury areas, it just drops off. And is there a structural underpinning of that? I know you've acted as a developer as well, Claire. So, you know, when you think about all of the houses, you know, out in the outer suburbs, is there some sort of structural setup that's not allowing that sense of follow through on sustainability or thought?
It's funny.
I mean, it's a bit of a big question, yeah. I guess.
I think we often, quite often with bigger, like, so developments, often in Australia there seems to be a tendency to look back in history. And so as in developers will often look to a real estate agent for historical data, like go, what sells?
Precedence.
What sells? And actually, and that's often what stifles innovation because you're doing what you've done over and over again. I mean, you can only look at things like what the Small Home Service did. So sometimes adversity. So the Small Home Service came about with Robin Boyd and yeah. It was post-war. So there was material shortages, there was a massive housing shortage, there was returned soldiers, and there was this optimism, which is why modernism kind of became this kind of interest. They built thousands and thousands of houses, you know, because there was this open-mindedness and it was almost like they'd drawn a line in the sand and there was this, you know, it's almost like what optimism has come from COVID, you know, like adversity. And, you know, we've change the way we work, you know, we
work from home,
so all those kind of things. So I do think sometimes we need this big disruptor. I don't know what the answer is to that. And you kind of also hope sometimes maybe it can be, you know, actually deregulating. Everyone says, oh, we've got too many regulations in the building industry. And we do have a lot, but deregulating is not, in my mind, is not the answer. Like we actually almost need to make people more accountable, that people are sort of actually forced to look at the carbon content of what's going into their buildings. It's only if we force people to all work to the same level, particularly developers. And developers will often say, if we're on an even keel, we'll all do it. You know, if it means we all have to put social housing as a small proportion of our buildings, or if we all have to meet this kind of criteria. So it is tricky because people say, oh, that stifles creativity, but I don't think it does. I just think you've got to design through it. And that actually means you need more design skills to find the answer through that.
Grats. Australian design, what does it mean to you?
I think there's, in the last 10 years, I've seen it shift for people actually asking where things are made. And I think there's a big part of the sustainability push is, you know, sure, you probably are paying a little bit more for something made in Australia, but it'll last, you know. And I think that, you know, it doesn't end up on the nature strip as hard, you know, hard rubbish and landfill. So I think there is more of a conscious thing. I mean, years ago you buy something and you'd hand it down to your children, or your grandchildren would inherit certain pieces and it would be handed down to from generation. I think there's a little bit of a shift back to that now, where people are buying something where they say, well, I want it to last, and I want it to, you know, I do want to buy a nice, even a bed, you know, that when my son moves out, he can take it with him. It's that they're the discussions that people are having, rather than just buying the cheap and cheerful one that, you know, will break straight away. Or so I think that's
refreshing
and and really positive. I used to almost apologize for things and how much they cost, you know, but I'd say, but I've made it like this and you won't have any problems with it, and it'll last you, and we can warranty it. And then that seems to get people saying, oh, well, that's true. Okay, well, that's good then. I'm happy to invest in those things. I mean, Amanda, you've been a supporter of Grazia & Co. too. You've got Featherstone pieces. You've reupholstered it and you still love it. So I think if you buy something good and it's well made and it's timeless in its design, then really there's no reason why you shouldn't have it for a long time. You know, so I think that's a positive for Australian manufacturing, for starters, and also for sustainability.
Your inclusion of your new collaboration with the Clement Meadmore range, I find it lovely to see how, you know, something from mid-century, you know, when I walked into your showroom and saw it there, it feels so now.
That's good design.
but isn't it?
Isn't it?
It's a reflection.
Yeah.
It does have a sense of nostalgia, but it's not,
no,
oh, we're doing this because it's nostalgic. It has sort of an interest and a cleanliness and the lines and just the materiality of it. And, you know, when I got to see how beautifully the legs were powder coated and the string around it, you know, it's really delightful.
Oh, thanks for that feedback, Amanda. Well,
no worries.
We did have to scale everything up because everything was much smaller. People were more my height. Now they're more Claire's height.
Now they're my height.
Well, the Meadmore family approached us. So that was the first thing where you kind of put in this position. There's pressure from the start to do the right thing. I realised that the materiality of what was used back in the 50s was just not going to, it just wouldn't meet Australian standards today. So we rethought it and I just thought, well, we can, instead of 9mm mild steel, we're going to make it out of 12mm stainless steel. Instead of cotton webbing, we're using nylon webbing, and we're going to reintroduce the collection as close as possible to the originals. And we had consultants helping us do that and make it as an outdoor collection. And I think the Meadmores were a bit, okay, but it's worked. And I think it's still being specified for interior use, but also outdoor. You just specified it for a commercial job.
Yeah. I've put a whole lot in my house too.
It's pretty beautiful.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So from that perspective, I think we've done it justice. The sling chair we only made a little bit deeper because it was quite shallow, but that was Quinton Meadmore's choice. He said, I'd love to see that chair go back. I was like, oh God, it's the hardest one to do. But we did it, and it's probably my favourite now too. So there's a sentimental connection to it because of his sentimental connection to it, and it's also because of the 3-year process of launching that range.
3 years.
3 years. You wouldn't think.
So what happens in year one? What happens in year two? And what happens in year three?
Well, first you have to source all the samples because there's no blueprints, and you're going back and forth with consultants. No, that's not right. That's not right. And you know.
So did you get samples?
We bought some samples. The sling chair I bought in from the US because it was originally made there, because Clement Meadmore was very successful in the US, and that was one product he actually launched in America. So we found one on the secondhand market and brought it over, and then basically pull it apart essentially. And it was chrome. We chose not to use chrome for environmental reasons, and we made it in polished stainless steel. It's a reinterpretation of the collection, but it still carries proudly, I think, the Meadmore name. I mean, there's people that don't even know who Meadmore was. So it's lovely when they come in, they go, oh, these are great. It's like, yeah, well, when you tell them they were designed in the 1950s, that I can't believe it, you know. There's not everyone has that history
or knows about
it. Yeah, knows about it.
Or people come to learn about it.
They learn about it, yeah. So that's been an honour, I think. That's probably, I'd say, my biggest achievement in 10 years would be launching that collection. I think it's pretty special for Australian design history.
And the NGV lent you some too, didn't they? They've got some in their permanent collection.
Yeah, the NGV, well, they were very supportive of the whole thing. So I think when you've got people like that backing you and supporting what you're doing, it gives you the confidence, but also puts pressure. Like, I've got to do it right, you know. And we did. I think we did the best we could, and it did take 3 years. But in between other things, we weren't just doing that. So and life, it's costly. It's very costly too.
You've both had your businesses for quite a while now. Do you reflect on what you've created, Graz?
Not daily, but I think at our 10-year mark, we did look back, and we started at the dining room table and then moved into a tiny little studio and seen our team grow. And I have to say the team we have are very loyal, and many of them have been with us for a long time. And I look at that and I'm really proud of that, what we've achieved together as a team. I also work with my husband.
How's that?
Has its moments, Amanda, I can tell you that. No, I wouldn't recommend it on a day.
How is it hard? Like, I mean, I couldn't work with my husband. We're different.
Steve is very pragmatic. His background, he's a fitter machinist.
So he's a doer.
Whereas I'm like, come on, let's get it quick. And he's more like accuracy and...
He's methodical.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good combo.
It is a great combo. I think we clash when it comes to I want things done quickly, he wants it done properly. We both want it really done properly.
But you've separated parts of the business. You're in different buildings.
We used to have text fights where we'd sit in the same office and we'd be like swearing and we'd have all our staff. And then in the end we realised this is not good for our marriage. So we did actually split the offices so they were in different buildings.
Oh, that's a great idea.
They're right next to each other. But, yeah, they're
just
in
a bit of environmental.
Yeah, physical separation. Yeah.
But it actually helped because there was.
It's like you're not micro on each other.
No. And then he would kind of step into the design thing and I'd be like giving him daggers. And then I would do things like, can we buy? And no. So he's also the financial side of the business. So it's a, believe it or not, it does work.
And do you talk about work when you get home?
We try not to. We do. We do sometimes, usually about a client that's given us the shits. We have a little
chat
about that. But no, not really. We do talk about other things too now. We've got other people running lots of areas now. Great. So it's not as hard.
Yes.
Not everything's on our plates.
You've got the rules of engagement down pat.
We do. We do, sort of. We think sometimes we don't, but overall we do.
Amazing.
I think Mead Moore drove him a bit crazy, but at the end he said, he was happy with it too. So
it's worthwhile.
Totally worthwhile. Yeah.
Claire, do you look back after 2 decades and think about what you've created?
No, I don't look back. We've reflected a little bit this year, and I was actually thinking just the other day it would be really nice just to have drinks and invite all of our old teammates back, you know,
the alumni.
Because there's the alumni, that's right, because there's so many have started their own practice and it's so interesting to see what they're doing. And it's really nice to be part of that. You know, a small part of their journey. It's a bit like, you know, we're so invested in our jobs at the projects that we've got on and off, and they can take 3, 5, 7 years. That when you move through them, and we do the nice thing is, I suppose, when you if you decide to put something into awards, you re-reflect, you photograph, you have to kind of write about it. So that's a kind of nice reflection. But we're so kind of onto the, you know, what's the next project? Yeah, but I'm very proud of 20 years. It's a long time, but I also think. I've only got so many jobs left until I finish, you know, until I retire, which is, you know, in another.
When are you retiring?
I don't know, in my 70s. I'm saying another 20 years. I've got another 20 years. But I'm like, but because we're only a small practice, like there's 12 of us, isn't it? We're only small. We can only do so many jobs at once. And so, yeah.
You've multiplied it out.
You roll your eyes and you go, oh, but it's like, but it's not like, but you go, well, I want every job to count, I suppose is what it is. I don't just want to do anything that comes through the door. We're lucky that we're in a position now that we can be a bit more strategic on what we do. Mm. So
it is a nice place to be. You know, I sometimes think to myself, oh, I better not say no to everything. You know, like, got to keep the business going, you know. I think the more you work through your business, you do become clearer about what you like doing and who you like doing it with.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, and I feel like the people, you know, they always say the people who give you energy.
Yep.
We want those clients. We want to work with the people that think like us. When I say think like us, I don't mean complicit.
Mm, but they're on board for them.
Yeah, and there's an energy level and an optimism. I guess optimism is something that we value highly, you know, when we're choosing who we work with, that these people are optimistic and what I call creatively brave enough to step into something where you don't know the outcome. And I think that's a huge indicator for us. You know, there are those clients who feel like they have to know every step of the way what's going to happen. And it's like, I don't actually know.
No.
You know, like I do know that if you put the right ingredients together and if you follow this process, it's going to work out, but you can't guarantee it. And I guess that's part of the, you know, I don't like this a sales technique as such, like, oh, it's going to be amazing. You'll decide if it's amazing at the end or not, you know, which is really an interesting way to look at things, I think, as well.
But it is, it's that trust, isn't it? Trust. I don't often think about it as optimism, but I think that's a really good way to phrase it too. But we find we just love the clients we're working with, and I can look back even, you know, only a few years ago where we had really hard clients, you know, and it was probably, I put it down to probably taking on some jobs during COVID because we weren't sure quite what was happening. The jobs were really nice. It's just the clients were difficult.
Difficult.
And we still produced, I think, a really good project, but it takes the wind out of your sails a lot, and it's exhausting, you know, and you kind of feel like they're second guessing and you think, why? And now we're just working with all these clients and they're so excited and so enthusiastic, and it's, and actually you want to work doubly as hard for those clients.
Of course. Yes,
you do. And it is a long game. You need to be tenacious and you've got to try and hold on to that energy for such a long time, and it's much easier to do that when you're working with people and you really want to work hard for them.
Mm. I do forget your projects are really long. Ours are 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, if someone gets on our quince, we know they'll be gone in 3 months.
Yeah.
Whereas but you're working
that just has to sell a table for, you know. And then she's like, never again.
Yeah.
She has done
but
that.
But that's true. Yours have, you've got pressure of time, turnover as well. Yeah. Like retail would be like that too, yeah, I'd imagine.
People say to us, oh, you guys are really quick. I think we move at a glacial, well, I do, at a glacial pace. I love that. Mm. But it is actually probably compared with an architectural project, it is quicker, you know. So when I say to people, oh, we're slow, I said, but not like architectural slow,
yeah,
you know, because it does take you time to see things.
Yeah.
How have you both managed your businesses? I guess you've got the business side and, you know, the creative side. What have been the great bits and the challenges of having your own businesses? And if you like, this is, I guess, a form of advice for people who are just starting out, young founders who are just starting out. I guess, what's your advice around the challenges of having a small business?
Well, I'd say the advice I'd give someone starting in a design business now is don't copy what someone else is already doing and come up with your own idea and a point of difference, because I've got a fundamental issue with people lining their own pockets with an idea that someone else has come up with. So if you're a designer, then be a designer and come up with something, you know, that is creatively yours rather than stealing it from somebody else. That would be, in the design industry, is one thing I would absolutely recommend.
I was talking with Peter King from Peter King Studio. I was asking him a similar question of, like, how do you continue to make original works? And his answer was, like, nothing's really original.
No.
You know, but I guess what we're all doing is we're all informed about the past. You know, we're observing what's happening now. And this thing, I feel, is part of your design process where you pull from your core. You pull from everything it is, your skill, your thoughts, all of that. I guess that's the alchemy or the magic that comes together to create, to step forward and put something down on paper that feels like you.
Yes.
I guess is the best way that I can describe when I have ideas that I think, oh, my God, I love that. Oh, my God, it's, you know, and you get excited about it, is somehow feels new or feels like your own.
Yeah.
And I think that is my best way of describing what original work might be.
Yeah. You know, we're all influenced by, like you said, the past and other things that you've seen before, that's especially now with socials.
What Gratz, I think, is referring to too, though, is with product, it's so much more blatantly
obvious.
Apparent and obvious, yes. You know, whereas in a more spatial project, you've got many, many different layers of things. It's very easy in the architecture and design world to go down the Pinterest route.
Yes.
And I look at Pinterest, I think it's kind of interesting, but it's so important to kind of think about why you're looking at it or what you're looking, you know. And
what you're looking for.
Sometimes actually we use it, if we haven't kind of moved into a 3D model, we actually will have designed it, but we sometimes actually then go to Pinterest to look to something to explain to the client, it's a little bit like this. It's kind of, we actually use it.
In reverse.
Yeah. But I'm very conscious that I'm always saying to the team, I don't want to show the whole thing, like just zoom in, or, you know, we're trying to sometimes just explain. It might be sometimes a spatial thing or a light quality or a material texture or something, because not everyone is very good at reading a plan or an early model, you know, and they need something a little bit more kind
tangible.
Of tangible. You asked about the business. I mean, I kind of really yes. love the business side of architecture, I think, because I like the not analysis. I just kind of, I think it's actually really important. I think we can't think of ourselves as struggling artists. We need to be successful creatives. And that doesn't mean you have to be primarily commercially minded. And we regularly with the team, I'll always say, even if I'm kind of talking about profitability or efficiency, and I'm kind of obsessed with efficiency, but at the same time, never at the, I'm obsessed with finding efficiencies. It's about, I always say, work harder, work strong, work efficiently.
What do I say?
Work totally efficiently, wrong. Not harder.
Yeah, no, work smarter, not harder is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Stuff that one up. But maybe that's why we're not doing it. No, I'm just joking.
That's not working, darling. But I've got to get it the right way.
But I'll always say, you know, you'll hear of some large, you know, businesses, they'll go run out of hours, not doing any more. Actually, my husband's a commercial builder, and he and his team sometimes go, can you have a look at this? Can you just tell us what heights we should put these lights? And I'm like, what is the architect doing? They go, oh, they've stopped working. They've run out of fees. And I do not understand that, you know, when, and this is on big projects, but it's our responsibility to kind of run them efficiently. Occasionally stuff goes wrong or you haven't charged it correctly. And yeah, you've probably run out of fees, but you've got to still deliver the project to the best, you know, so that is the most important thing.
I love it. I love it. What would you like people to know about your business?
I'd like everyone to know that it's Melbourne made.
Beautiful.
Everything's made in Melbourne, proudly made in Melbourne.
That's close. That's really
maybe,
close.
Maybe not the fabrics there. They're all imported. But what's made by us is made in Melbourne.
I'd like to talk about red tape and breaking rules. I feel like even 25 years ago when we started, I didn't feel like there were any rules. Basically because we were working in a new area of on the edge of design, call it. But I feel like there's a lot of red tape around. So I guess my question is that the same for you? And I'm imagining if people are starting businesses these days, it might be hard for them coming in with the amount of red tape that goes on, particularly in architecture. Red tape versus breaking rules. Where do you sit on that?
There's a lot of rules you can't break and that you have to work within. And so often I sometimes almost find projects harder when there's too few constraints. You know, it's like almost that analogy of give me a big kind of rural country, like rolling hill, I'm like, I don't really know what to do on it, you know, because we're so used to the constraints of a city block or with all these kind of challenges. But we kind of lean into the constraints because often like we're finding now lots of sites have flood issue, you know, inner Melbourne sites, flood issues, overland flow, this, that, and the other. All these kind of site environmental issues, we kind of relish them because they add complexity, but then they really need a great design solution to kind of design through them so that they're not visually apparent that there are these challenges. On the flip side, we do like on our bigger projects where we're often met with kind of planning envelopes, that's where we find our role is to try and really, it's not about, you can't push up against everything, but there are times where you can say use design excellence to challenge a convention that we think is not necessarily leading to great kind of civic outcomes. So it might be that a building envelope goes up and then it goes back on a diagonal and you get these kind of awful kind of forms. And so sometimes we'll kind of say to the responsible authority, we'll demonstrate that if we do it this way and maybe do one big step, you know, it's kind of those challenging, breaking the rules with planning. And if you can do that and actually get better outcomes.
Work within the system sometimes.
Yeah.
I love that. What about you, Grants?
I think
breaking rules every day.
All the time. No. I think we have to make things that are fit for purpose at the end of the day. If you're making furniture, it has to
work.
We've got weight loads, Australian standards on chairs and duals, so they all have to be met. But I don't see our industry or the furniture industries being that regulated, really. There's a formula that you kind of go into, you know what the market expects.
How do you market your business, Grants? Yeah? How do you get out to your people? What do you do? And look, I know you're an amazing chatter about your product. Like we always come back from the showroom and it'll be Luce, you know, or Jahan or, you know, back in the day, Steph, and we go, God, Grazia just makes you fall in love with that stuff. We're going to order it. We know we are.
Oh, that's not. I think we do have a very passionate sales team. Genuinely, they love it. And I think it's much easier to sell something that you like. So they do actually all like the product. I mean, I'm still passionate about what we sell too. And I think that people can see through when you're not really. So, yeah, we definitely do the old school, talk about it and be proud of it. We've got social media like most people do and the website. We're a trade business primarily. So to be honest, a lot of our clients are repeat clients who have been very loyal and I've known for a long time. So I think when you get to a point where you can say to a client, I don't think that's a good idea because of this, there's a sense of trust there. So I think we market ourselves on doing the right thing. And no, I can't do that in 3 weeks, but I could do it in six, as, you know, rather than just saying, yeah, we can do it and then let you down. There's those kinds of things that I think help market you just internally.
You've touched on something that's so important is relationships over time. Oh. If you build relationships over time, clearly you have a business going on, you know, and that's definitely how we work with our clients as well.
Yeah.
You know, we do one project and they go, we all sit back at the end of it and go, that was fun, let's do it again, you know. So I feel like that if you can build those relationships, then you have a business. Is the best way I can look at it. Yep. As well.
It is about the relationship first, I'd say. Sometimes they just come and they don't even know what we've got on offer, but they use this last time and they're like, okay, I've got a different job, what can I use? I mean, that's the biggest compliment when they come back and they don't even know what they want to buy from you yet.
Just looking
and they still proceed, which is great.
I love it. What about you, Claire? How do you market? I mean, people know who you are now. You've got everyone sort of has an understanding of what you've achieved and the style of things you love to create. What are your thoughts like? Do you use web, long form, social? What are your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, I think when we started, there was no social media. We had a fax machine, Amanda. You know,
that's I love the fax machine.
We had a fax machine when we opened
the
doors. And we didn't have a website. And it was so interesting because it took about 3 years until we photographed a house that we did in Albert Park, which we, you know, Anne-Marie Keeley luckily wrote about it, got it into Vogue, which was terrific.
Yes.
But then that was 3 years. And then it's like, okay, great. Who else wants to work with us? You know? And so the landscape has changed so rapidly now. I think, you know, another thing we never did, we never invested well in photography in our projects early on. We didn't think we could afford it and it's just so fundamentally important. But our biggest thing has just been, like Grats, it's just our best marketing is doing a great job for our clients. So I think in the early years I used to say I could draw a tree, like a family tree of our clients, because it was kind of, sometimes people would come with a clipping that they'd seen us in a magazine, you know, but most of the time it was like so-and-so recommended or we'd do repeat work and it all kind of fed back to these kind of early clients. And now, yeah, we use Instagram. I'm not very good at, I mean, I do that. I don't do it very, I'm not very frequent with it. I don't like accounts where people kind of bombard you with too much information. So I prefer it. We post infrequently, but it's probably a bit more
just when you've got something to say.
When we've got something to say, exactly, yeah. Rather than having a kind of whole scheduled thing. But we're now doing a fourth house for a client that we've done three. You know, they're just such, wow. Almost become serious. You know, they love, but it's, you know, we've done three for them in Melbourne.
They can't get enough.
And now they're doing one in Sydney that we're doing for them. And they're just so delightful. And that's a really great compliment when people want to continue to work with you and the projects get slightly bigger or slightly different or geographically change. And, yeah, it's really good.
Do you think it's been an advantage in the roles you've had in the wider industry? As a founder, you talk a lot about different things. You talk about housing, you're on podcasts, you're always sort of talking about architecture. Do you think that as a founder that has helped your business?
When your name is on the door, so to speak, you know, you end up being the
and
one.
And yours
that
really is.
Yeah, that's right. The full name. And the thing was, back when I started, I looked to people who were already practicing, you know, kind of who were, and it was like Kirsten Thompson Architects, John Wardle Architects, you know, Sean Godsell Architects. And that's what everyone used to call themselves. Yeah. You know, people didn't have new names, you know.
Like
so
gloss.
I just followed what everyone else was doing at the time. But there's a kind of an advantage and disadvantage because it's that thing where, you know, everyone kind of looks to you. I mean, I've got a terrific team and people who've been with us for a very long time. Ollie's been, I think, 12, 13 years and he's director of architecture. And so I naturally am the kind of willing kind of spokesperson or enjoy doing those things. But often, I suppose sometimes they are to the public and other times it's you're talking to the industry, you know, and you're not really going to get clients from the industry.
No, they're your peers.
They're your peers. So I must say I don't feel like I do it for that that reason. I think I love listening about how other people's process, and I think it can be really insightful. And you might go, oh, I would never have thought of that. And it might, you know, make someone, you know, I would, when I listen to other people speak about the way they work, I often will take, you know, have little takeaways, and that, you know, anyway, it's just a nice way to kind of hear. I think we're always learning, you know, there's always things that we can do differently and change.
I guess that is, you know, as you said, hearing from other founders, it makes you think about, you reflect on your own practice as well. How are you both using AI, or are you?
Well, we've just started dabbling with it. It's a minefield. There's a lot of things you can do. Yeah, from a product visualization point of view, we've just started, you know, from a concept point of view and entering it all in. It's impressive.
It's mind-boggling, actually.
Mind-boggling, yeah. I don't know whether you'd make it a complete tool yet. I'm not sure. I think we were just experimenting in it, and it's you can see where it could take you, though.
Mm, definitely.
So we've only just started, though. It's certainly not me doing it.
What about
the younger?
You?
Yeah, we're trying to kind of find time to experiment a bit more too. Like, we've used it a little bit with, because we create in-house 3D renders, and we've kind of been often taking renders and seeing whether you can kind of make more the environment that the building sits in and use that tool a little bit more. I think there's a bit of a way to go. I think some of the team have experimented, you know, when they're trying to tidy up kind of text for submissions and things, that can be quite good. And ironically, funnily, we do these funny birthday cards, which is a bit of a tradition. When it's someone's birthday, we have a cake, and someone always generally does a kind of funny Photoshop card in a very unflattering way for the, you know, they're very entertaining, but they always used to take someone about 4 hours, you know, and now they do it and they just
5 minutes
text prompt it, and it's like in, out, and it's like, but the funny thing is the things that are coming out are hilarious. So anyway, so it's quite, it's good, but I think it is going to be really interesting to see what happens in the next few years.
As the new technologies come out and that's people start to use them.
Yeah,
really interesting. What's the shape of your days?
I feel like we both just get up and run.
Run.
The whole day. Yeah. Drink, sleep, eat, run again. It does feel a little bit like that at times. Mm. Well, you know, I'll do a factory run, or a lot of the time I spend in the office. It just depends on what's happening, but it's constant. You're the same.
Mm.
You're in a meeting every 10 minutes.
Mm. I go to site. I'm sad. I mean, I'm not on site as much as I used to be, which I kind of really love being on site. A lot of meetings with the team, kind of try to set up change our systems a little bit more, where I'm kind of trying to pull myself a little bit more out of the design development and documentation meetings, just because you can only spread yourself so thin. You've actually got to go, okay, which ones do I, you know, but I can't help myself. I just want to be
in everything.
Yeah, and we're trying some different things. And then I tend to meet all the prospective clients and, you know, do that. So there's actually still quite a lot of admin, even though Laura, we've got a practice manager that does that. But ultimately, if we're meeting a new client, it's, you know, it's me and talking to people about that, or designing new projects or presenting those new projects, and then just walking around the office kind of answering problem solving and different things. So it's good. It's always varied. But I love that part of it. I love that it's different. And, you know, sometimes you might be sitting on your chair all day just in Zoom meetings. I actually love working from home on a Wednesday. That's kind of kept that after lockdown. I do find it's the day that I can, even though I can still be on meetings with the team, it was supposed to be more of a creative isolation day, which I'm hoping to get back to that soon. But I just feel like often there's always someone at my door, like a little bit henpecked, you know. I just need this. You know, it's like little baby birds. They're just always with their mouth open wanting a little bit of a worm dropped in. So it is quite nice having that. I just find as a mental relief, you know, to have a bit more kind of concentration, to have a day from home is really great.
So if I said work-life balance to you, what would that mean to you right now?
I think when you're so invested in, you know, like I worked a bit yesterday because I wanted to get ahead for the week, and, you know, I see things, you're always kind of on the lookout or collecting things. And I think if you could, that could either stress you out, and you could think it's negative that it's always it's imparting on your private life. But when you like it, it doesn't kind of really bother me. There's other times I try and be very diligent. Occasionally I have to work at night, but I've never get an email. I've got no notifications on my email on my phone. So I don't read an email at night. Often I'll go weekends, I don't look at an email. So I think there's ways of,
yes,
you do have to compartmentalize and give yourself the boundaries. And then some days you go, actually, you know what, I'm going to do a couple of hours because I just want to get a head start on the week. And then I don't find that stressful because I actually just, I know I'm going to start the day tomorrow a bit easier. So I think my kids would say I work too much too, but I think, you know, both our kids, I think that they can see what it's like though to have, my husband has his own business too, like independent, hard working, you know, and I think they're good traits for children to observe and watch and
take in by osmosis.
Yeah. I think they just don't like that I expect them to help out quite a lot around the house.
And, oh, that's good. Know,
yeah, but I'm like, run a tight ship here. You know.
Oh, they're great girls.
They're very good girls, yeah. I love them.
What about you, Grant? What's work-life balance for you?
If I can not, if Steve and I can both not work on a weekend, that's a good thing. I think as Orlando gets older, and I think Steve's fitting in different things even during the week. He's playing golf, which always makes him in a better mood during the week, during the rest of the week. So I think it's little moments of that. I'm not there yet, but occasionally we'll have a little social lunch, or even today's a bit of a break from the normal.
I love it. All right. Got some quicker questions for you guys. What's been your most interesting day at work ever?
Well, you could sort of say that's the thing too. You talk about work-life balance, but then actually my work takes me to amazing places, you know. So, like, for example, I did this fantastic trip last year to India with these 9 women architects, great dear friends. And I kept reminding my team and my family, this is a work trip, you know, but it absolutely was. Like, it was, we had 10 days and in, you know, the north and the west, and every day was this full immersion of looking at buildings, touring. There wasn't even any time for shopping, you know. We're like, what are we going to do, get any shop, you know. And you kind of think, well, this is kind of amazing that this is legitimate. You kind of pinch yourself thinking this doesn't feel like work, but it was just amazing. And so you kind of think, well, if that's your most amazing, if that's work, that's a pretty amazing day. And it was so memorable that it had all been on our bucket list for such a long time. And to do it with all these kind of women who run their own business, just to kind of step away from the day-to-day and do that and be in a faraway place looking at ancient architecture, and it was amazing. Yeah.
What a gift.
Mm.
I love it. What about you?
Oh, a good day or an interesting day is when you finally have gone through the prototyping stage and you've finished a product and everyone's looking at it and loving it. That's always a moment, and it doesn't happen that often because it's not like fashion. We're not producing lots of pieces of a year. So when that happens, there's these little, or you might see something that someone specified or a designer's had made, and everyone has a look at it and they're like, oh, wow, that looks great. There's little moments like that which are always rewarding. I think travel is another thing. I think Claire and I have travelled together and also separately, but you always get something out of it that you can relate back to work, I think. And like you said, Claire, you do thread them together even subconsciously, or, you know, you might be sitting at a banquet somewhere and you're like, oh, that's a nice detail, or there's things like that that are constant in, if you love what you do, you're looking for those things all the time no matter where you go.
A pretty great day.
What about you?
Travel. Oh, so many. I've had so many great, interesting days at work. I mean, there's probably an interesting day at work every week for me.
That's
great. Yeah. Like one week, you know, it's NGV, it's Chanel, it's Mecca, BRC, it's incredibly varied all the time.
Yeah.
And travel's just like mind-blowing as well. I always find I learn so much. And when I travel, I feel like I'm reinventing myself through seeing how others live,
yes,
or design, mm, or the level of thinking that they have created for you to look at and take whatever you need from that. So I think you're right, travel's so interesting. And I guess the amount of different people I get to work with, and seeing the different skill level of people that I've worked with. As I said, you know, we're at the edge of the design world, and I see, you know, what like Woods Marsh did and what you do. So I get to see into a lot of different worlds across a lot of industries,
yeah,
and different genre of design, or, you know, I get to see marketing teams and event teams. So I get to see this breadth of creativity and diversity in people's skills, which I find mind-blowing, which is pretty amazing. In establishing your businesses, what rule do you think you broke?
Well, I never wrote a business plan. I don't know if you're supposed to.
You're supposed to, but I haven't met anyone who sat here who actually had one.
No. Did you write one?
No. God, no.
So boring. What rule did you break?
Break all the rules, Claire. You should know that.
None. Yours is easy.
What?
That's mine.
you dared to say you can manufacture things in Australia, beautiful things.
Well, yes, it was done before, but it's definitely something that was dying. So to resurrect it in our own little sandpit's been great in Melbourne. I think one of the key things in our business was that I always wanted to stay small. And even though we've stayed small, like with the team, I feel like the business has still been able to grow, but we've been able to manage. You know how people say you need someone to do that and you need someone to do that, whereas I feel we've managed to have really super talented and clever staff that can actually do two or three roles, and I think that's worked really well. We don't have someone that does just our marketing. You know, we have Emma does marketing and sales, you know. So I think not that that's breaking a rule, but you know how people look into a business and they say, well, you need someone to do this or a practice manager or an accountant, those kinds of things. We've always kept it shared roles a lot of the time and we all help each other out. I think that, you know, someone I can step back into production and someone in production could come into sales. There's a bit of cross roles, which I think is works for a small business, because if someone's away, someone else can step in. I think that's needed in a small business for overheads and things like that. But, you know, there have been times where I've thought I'd like a practice manager too. But
I can't tell you how much I love that answer. Honestly, I love this concept that being small and being efficient doesn't mean you can't do stuff. It's like Claire was saying before, so many Australian businesses punch above their weight. And I love the idea that you can still be fairly small but do high-quality work, because we all know that revenue is no predictor of profitability. So, you know, you see sometimes people grow their businesses but the business doesn't necessarily grow.
No, that's
so,
right.
You know, sometimes, you know, what you can create as a smaller business is still very satisfying. That's what I've found anyway.
I think that the team have enjoyed the fact that their days are not all the same. You know, sometimes they might be doing marketing work and other times they might be working on something else. So they're not bored either. They're crossing over into their roles. I think that does actually work. I know I do. When you're crossing over from sales to development to production,
it's interesting.
It keeps everyone interested.
And it keeps the vibe and everyone knows what's going on. It's fun. What rules did you break in starting Claire Cousins Architects?
I don't feel like there was rules, but what was interesting at the time when I started, there were next to no single director female practices. So there was Kirsten Thompson, who's still kind of
the Pope of architecture.
Yes, exactly. I always remind her she's my mentor. She's a great mentor to many. And there were a few female partnerships. And there was Shelley Penn too, but Shelley's career has gone in a different path into kind of more working on boards and things. And so that made it slightly more daunting, because I'm such a big believer in seeing what you can be. But it was great to have those. And I kind of often think, well, Kirsten would have had next to no women to look to, you know. So, and it's amazing. So she's exactly 10 years older than me. And then I've got friends who are exactly 10 years younger than me in practice. And the change in the landscape is unbelievable. So it's kind of, so it's not really breaking a rule, but it's just interesting, as I suppose taking a leap of faith when it's not commonly done or at that time. But the change that's happened, you know, I've got many great female friends who are all leading practices as sole directors and loving it and succeeding. And you know, none of us like to think of ourselves as women architects anyway. It's just we're architects amongst friends. But
of course,
it just was that it was very male dominated in the early 2000s.
I love it. Are you front of house or back of house?
I'm very front of house, but I do love, I'm very happy
You're
to. You're
very front.
Oh. I know. But I'm very happy to roll my sleeves up and be back of house when I need to be. I've got a fantastic team, but a lot of them are quite quiet achievers. And so, as Grant says, there's only room for one diva in our office.
And that is you.
So, yeah.
What about you, Grant, front or back?
I'm both. Have to say, okay. I'm at the front when there's a problem, I can tell you that. But a lot of the time I actually prefer being the back. Got a very good team who are front of house, so they know all the clients. I mean, I step in also, but I actually am both. I can do both. I would do 50-50, I'd say.
Great. Well, I'd officially like to say that I feel like you're more front of house now that you've actually come on the podcast.
Yes, that's right.
It's taken about 2 years.
Yeah.
Grazia and Claire, thank you so much for being with us today. I've just loved it, and I'm sure everyone listening is going to absolutely love it as well. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks Amanda.